Hello, reader. I'm Alex.
I'm Kelly.
And this is the LitJoy Podcast. Today's episode, we are going to do part three of the series that no one asked for. Book to movie adaptations. Yeah. You're welcome.
It's where we get to talk shit about all movies. The movies. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, we also get to gush about them, but it's also like, why the hell not?
Exactly.
It's our podcast. Buckle up.
Well, we've been talking through all kinds of movies, book to movie adaptions, a lot of classics, as well as a lot of these fantasy books that have come out in the last 20 years. And we have more to talk about.
Always.
But it's kind of a new recent phenomenon. We've been discussing that, you know, 20 years ago, we would be lucky if we got one of the books we were reading to be adapted into a movie. Mm-hmm. And things have just changed. We've seen a huge shift culturally in people's interest level with books gaining quite a fandom.
Yes.
And I think Hollywood has been like, there's something here.
I mean, yes, with just like, I mean, books being made into movies has been done since silent movies, which we'll talk about in this episode.
Yeah.
But it does seem like there is kind of a formula where it's like translating a book into a screenplay seems to take out some of the work in the creation of the film, and it, or I guess the creation of the script. And it also feels like it comes with a little built-in fandom.
Yeah.
So it's like they know they're going to at least get the book fans out, kind of a thing. So it feels maybe less risky for production studios.
Yeah. Well, and I should stipulate that 20 years ago, they just weren't making book to movie adaptions so quickly.
Right.
It's kind of what I meant. So thank you.
The book would be out for like 10 years before they would consider picking it up.
Yeah. I mean,
it was actually, when we were talking about Jurassic Park in a previous episode, I was surprised how quickly that got made into a film.
Mm.
Because it was like within a year of the book coming out or something.
We talked about this a little bit with when we spoke with a literary agent. I believe it was the Susie Townsend episode. And she talked a little bit about what it can mean for a movie or a book, to be adapted to the big screen. Like there's all these parameters that have to fall into place. And it's quite a large following that needs to happen. And even then, Hollywood's like, maybe.
Yeah. It just seems like those production companies, though, they snatch up all the rights.
They do.
There was recently a rumor. Oh. From the rumor mill, I report to you. There was recently a rumor that Sarah J. Maas, her ACOTAR series, got canceled. And then Vanity Fair or someone actually reached out to the production studio, and that's not true. So
really?
ACOTAR, Throne of Glass, it may be a combo or maybe just ACOTAR. They haven't like fully fleshed or like announced anything.
Okay.
But I think it still is in the works.
Ah, because that was, the Hulu was going to adapt it.
That's right.
Right. From whoever, who directed, Outlander.
Yeah.
It was like this whole thing. Everyone's been so excited to put together their dream cast. And then I heard the same rumor and I was like,
I think I would just like refuse to be cast as the main in Sarah J. Maas.
The pressure.
I'd just be like, absolutely not. I'm like, I don't care. I will quit acting. Just because people are vicious. Yeah. When people like take it personally, they identify with a book. And so turning it into a movie is like, sometimes people can be, they're not best self.
They're heated because they're so passionate.
Sometimes people can like literally attack an actress or an actor who, and it's their job to take a role and to portray it. But it's just like, you don't need to be unkind because they're not a threat to your identity. But I'm like, people get hot.
But it feels like an attack to their identity, right? That's how passionate these book lovers are. And
I know.
The fandoms that they're created around it. Which we're going to be talking about that a little bit as well, because we have another episode about books to read if you have been obsessed and love reading Sarah J. Maas. So
I know.
Check that one out.
All the spicy people out there. Let's jump into it. Well, it is hard to make everyone happy with a movie, for sure.
Yeah.
So we're going to jump in with The Giver to start by Lois Lowry.
Yeah, let's do that.
This book, I think, was pretty formative for both of us in our childhood.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. This was like fifth grade for me, sixth grade, right? That's about when it gets introduced. And it was the first book that made me think.
Yeah.
And like blew my mind to the possibility of like anything dystopian. What if we didn't have memories? Like, I just remember it peeling back this layer of my thought process that I got to uncover for the first time. So I really appreciated The Giver for that, because it started me on this whole journey of like, well, what if? And wanting to learn more and just have complete tangents that I can run down. And that's when I got into pick your own adventure books.
That's amazing.
You remember those?
Yes, I
do. Those are so fun. Turn to this page if you want to see what happens in this direction. And it just kind of ignited a fire for me to, look beyond myself.
Yeah.
As a fifth grader.
Like to be curious and then to realize if there's this story. It was the first story I read where I could not put it down. Mm-hmm. And so it was such a beautiful introductory into loving fiction. And because I had read many picture books as a child and a couple of books for school, but it was the first one I picked up. And on my own, I wanted to go into this world, and it made me very curious about other books as well.
Yeah,
I think the thing that is pretty timeless about The Giver, it's so interesting. So in The Giver, I think I wrote down the main character. I can't remember his name, Jonas. So he lives in this, it seems like it's a utopian society, but as you are reading the book, you realize it's dystopian, and that they have basically neutralized many parts of society. They've modified people to only be to see in black and white. Mm-hmm. They've taken out color. They've taken out many experiences with emotions. They have given people jobs. People are not in agency. And it's all with the idea of creating this utopian type.
The greater good.
Yes, to take out all of friction, because that would be peace, right? And so it's peace by basically distilling everything. And what's so interesting is they do have a memory keeper as one of the jobs.
Yeah.
And it's very critical to the book. It's The Giver. It's when a new memory keeper is called to their job. Mm. Then the giver, the old memory keeper, becomes the giver. And he in this book gives memories mm-hmm. to the next memory keeper. And these memories are things like color and history and war and love and democracy and dictatorship, all these things. And I always thought it was so interesting why they felt the need to, even though they distilled everything, why did they feel the need to keep record of history. Mm. And so I think as an adult, that's the interesting part of it.
Yeah, it reminds me of when we read Station 11. Mm-hmm. It's similar in that, you know, another dystopian type world. This one is overran by basically a disease that gives people almost like a zombie-like disease.
Yeah.
And like 95% of the population is deceased because of it. And so whoever's left are roaming the earth. And one of the themes in that book is very similar to, we want to keep art and literature and performances and just like the history. We want to keep it alive. We don't want it to die because it's part of who we are.
Yeah.
And I think the thought of not knowing who you are is fundamental to that book, right?
Yeah.
And not knowing all of it. I feel like that every day, but it's different because it's not by choice. It's not by a natural unfolding of anything. It is like, no, you stole that from me.
Yeah.
So I'm going to admit it. I have not watched the movie.
I will talk about
on this one because I think I was nervous that I would have a hard time with it. It's a hard book. There's a few hard moments in it.
It is. Okay, so I'm just going to read the cast of this movie, which I thought was most interesting. The cast is stacked. It has, so Brenton Thwaites is Jonas. He's kind of, it's kind of like a breakout role. Yeah. He's young. Jeff Bridges.
Oh, wow.
Meryl Streep. Taylor Swift, which is interesting. Alexander Skarsgård. Katie Holmes and Odea Rush. Wow. These are kind of like fucking heavy hitters.
Yeah, those are
And it deals. Was like a B-minus film.
That's
the
risk.
They didn't get the feeling of the book quite right. Mm. I don't know why. I think that it felt the stakes didn't feel quite high enough. And they also tried to like bring in some like fighter crafts at the end because, you know, one of the characters escapes. Yeah. And they even tried to like make it more cinematic. And I think what they missed is that it could have been a really great psychological thriller.
Yeah.
And I think they were trying to appeal to adults and children, and they were trying to jazz it up to be more big screen. Mm-hmm. And they kind of missed just the heart of the book, which is this idea of like psychologically being cracked open.
Mm.
Kind of. And also in the book, you don't realize how dystopian it is. It really feels utopian.
Yeah.
And it's hard because when you're watching a movie, you just kind of know it's dystopian. You can't, there, like with on the page, there's more you can keep hidden from the reader mm-hmm. than when you're watching the movie.
Yeah.
And so I think it needed a little bit of refining.
Gotcha. Because I didn't know if it was similar to like The Book Thief, which I've talked about many times. Beautiful book, and they adapted it to the big screen. It was a beautiful movie.
It was.
But there's something that they couldn't duplicate. There's this certain elements of books you cannot duplicate. And I yeah. felt like that was one of them because the book was narrated by Def. And they obviously had to cut that out basically of the movie.
It was in there a little bit. You had to be much more involved
yes.
in the life of the character.
They kind of tucked him into the characters, mm-hmm. which makes sense. But I liked that like otherworldly view of witnessing humanity.
Yeah.
In that way. And so I just treated those ones very separate. But yeah, it sounds like The Giver, there's just some moments where they could have possibly refined it. And there's just a possibility that maybe it's just a tricky one to adapt because
yeah.
a psychological thriller, that's a great suggestion, Hollywood.
I was like, I'm just going to make some suggestions.
Redo.
As if like I've produced a movie. I'm all,
Did you feel like the characters for the, like they picked the right people, actors, and stuff for the characters?
Okay. What it felt like is it felt like they're like, if we just cram enough talented people into this film and then we have like a high speed jet chase,
it'd be great. Tom like, Cruise would be so proud.
Yeah. That'll just total. He's like, I must be running. it'll be a fucking hit. And I'm like, I was like, yeah, you can have the most talented actors. And I just felt like the writing wasn't strong enough. Mm-hmm. And like, there were a couple moments where it was kind of just like, I don't know if this is net. Like the stakes didn't feel as high as they did in the book. However, you did try and put a couple of like very Hollywood things in there to like make up for it. And it didn't feel necessarily authentic to the story. And so, which is interesting because I felt like Hunger Games actually was a really good comparison. The Hunger Games films, I felt like did a really good job of bridging young adult with adult. And
yeah,
that there was
agree.
Definitely like the stakes of war were very mm-hmm. clear and were high enough. And also any additional cinematic things they added in, it felt more like a action thriller
mm-hmm.
than it didn't feel like it was forced there. Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, so. It felt like a good adaption mm-hmm. to the big screen where if they edited anything out, I was like, oh, I see why, and it's fine.
Yes.
It's kind of how it felt. And they stayed true to the books.
Yeah.
And I think for me, it's like, it is the arc of the character there.
Yeah.
Because when that gets missed.
You know what? Okay, yes. So that reminds, like in The Giver, they tried to make it like Hunger Games, but they should have tried to make it like The Village.
Mm, oh, yeah.
That's probably where it would have been more compelling, mm. but I did view it as an adult. So if they're like, I bet if you ask most 12-year-olds who saw The Giver movie, they'd be like, it was us.
It's freaking rad. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, so. Who knows? It reminds me of like when they redid A Wrinkle in Time.
Yeah.
With Oprah and stuff. I'm all.
They were like, how many cool people can we just get in this movie?
Yeah. Like they had a lot of great actors in there, but just didn't hit.
I don't even know if the book hits, but that's my own personal preference.
You know. It's a classic, so we don't get to discuss whether or not it should be continuing on in adaptions. It's just going to happen.
Yeah.
That's how I feel about it.
They're like, if it's public domain, everyone's like, let's do it.
Rock on. Yeah.
I have to pay royalties. Yeah.
That's okay. Amazing. So okay. Giver was our first one. We're moving on to something more classic.
Yes. I tried to stagger these like more contemporary, more classic, because otherwise it'd just be a lot of romance regency angst. Let's talk about Jane Eyre and how that story is completely effed up.
Most of the classics are pretty toxic when I think about like a lot of the relationships, right?
Yeah.
But that's part of why we enjoy them.
It's part of the charm.
It's lovely to hear about red-flagged people and couples.
But red flag, sir.
Jane Eyre is so fun because it's like a ghost story too.
Yes.
And a bit of a murder mystery kind of feel. The whole time you're just like, the suspense is palpable throughout the book and you're just like waiting for something to happen. And then when it does, I was just pulling my hair out. I was like, what? Like, I couldn't believe how it all ends. So it's a great story.
I mean, yes, one of the best plot twists, because you think it's a haunting and then, you know.
Yeah.
And it is. It's just not what you expect. Yeah. I'm like, okay, so it was written by Charlotte Bronte, 1847. It was published under a pen name, Currer Bell.
Ooh,
I was like, oh, like Charlotte Bronte, CB. So this book was written in the Gothic literary trend that was happening at the time. So you definitely get the romance, which was like women's fiction back then, right? Still, but it is a romance, but yeah. Gothic, very macabre in like its execution.
Oh. Yeah, just the description of like the moors, you know, and like,
yes, it's mood.
Very moody. It's always like drizzly, a little gray. It's really fog and just these sheer cliffs and wind, like the way it's described feels very like there's this, like you mentioned, Gothic, but it's cold, kind of desolate.
It's angst.
Yeah.
So I feel like what Charlotte Bronte does in Jane Eyre is she really uses weather and setting as a character to set the stage for what's going on in the characters' lives. I'm like, Jane has such a tragic story. So I mean, the ending is, there is this redeeming experience for her, which I think people are really drawn to. Other psychological elements that this book, what makes it so interesting, I'm like, there is like the toxic male protagonist that I'm like, I don't understand fully the obsession with Rochester, but people love him. Like, love him. And I'm like, he gaslights her the entire book. And then she's like, I would do anything for you. And I'm like, nah. I was like, he can't even help that much. If you read the book, you'll know why. I'm just like, now she's supposed to take care. Now she's his mother. I don't know. I get to the end and I'm like, rage.
Doesn't it make you think too, though, like 100 years from now, people are going to look back on the books that we love currently, and they're just like, going to be like,
they had a thing with fairies, man.
They're like, what the fuck? Red flags everywhere. What were they into? You
know? I just picture that red flag guy running in front of us
with a giant red flag. Yeah, I'm like, I know a lot of it's cultural, right? We were just talking about this the other day about how some of our favorite children's authors are being censored now. And I absolutely understand and get it. I get it.
Yeah.
We're just talking about like Roald Dahl, Dr. Seuss, you know, plays, but those were classics and staples in our homes. And now they're all getting like a facelift where they're taking out problematic things and words.
Flipping and pinning back and
give a little Botox, you know? And you get mixed reviews, people who are so upset that you would touch that manuscript, the original.
Yeah.
Because it's what we know. But in reality, I'm like, I'd like to not have to read to my children about, you know, like in something about someone being fat and overweight and or what they'll even say something that's just so inappropriate now. I don't even want to say it. I'm just but it was normal text 100 years ago.
Oh, yes.
And so when we're talking about like Jane Eyre, absolutely. That's why I love like Wuthering Heights and Jane Eyre, because I'm psychologically breaking down the characters and all the issues. Yes. But also it's like watching a reality show.
It totally is. Yeah. It totally hits on that same part of your brain where it's like reality TV where you're like, okay, I have my favorites.
Yeah.
And they're all freaking toxic and I'm not going to look away.
Let's see who's going to blow up first. Who's going to just completely take out everybody with their emotional grenade?
Who's going to light a bed on fire?
This episode is brought to you by our officially licensed Cassandra Clare collection. And today we're really excited to talk to you about one of the prop items we're going to be dropping. It is the Mortal Cup replica. This cup replica is made of antique gold-plated metal. It is stunning when you see it in person. It is considered a prop-only item.
And I think the reason we say prop-only is just don't plan on filling it full of like hot tea and drinking from it. Because I think it is designed artistically, specifically to look like a perfect replica of the mortal cup. So I'm like, that'll be interesting to see how people display it. I'm really excited. So it drops to the Lunacorns in the shop on April 10th. Now, as a reminder, our Lunacorns is a private membership group, and you can check out Lunacorns on our website under the VIP membership. On the 10th, they get early access. On the 11th is April 11th is when it drops to the public. So we also wanted to make note, we just dropped the Mortal Instruments Book of the Book of the White replica. So the Book of the White is another fun in-world prop type product, but it is actually a journal on the inside. And that is for sale at $17 if we still have some available in the shop. So go check it out. You can find all of the Cassandra Clare collection at litjoycrate.com/Cassie. That's litjoycrate.com/CASSIE. It's freaking awesome. Okay, so that is my favorite part of the book of Jane Eyre is that whole, like, the mystery element. Yeah. Oh, it's so good. That's the psychological thriller part of it.
Yeah.
Where you're like, are we all crazy? Or is something happening here? Is this a haunting? I love it.
And I was thinking about your question, like, why are all these women so into Rochester? Especially back then, right? When this is like mid-1800s.
Yes.
He takes such an interest in Jane. Like, he genuinely seems to love learning about her. And he asks her questions. He wants to know her deep thoughts, and he never opens up to anybody, right? So that's just immediate like catnip for people, especially those of us who are like, well, we can change him.
We can fix him.
He'll change, you know, if I'm just sweet enough and give him this love, you know. And that's, I think, at the heart of it. And well, that's why I get it.
That's a great point. I'm like,
but also red flags,
red flag. I'm just going to go through because apparently people have a lot of feelings about Jane Eyre. There have been tons of adaptations of Jane Eyre. First of all, silent films, 8 total, starting in 1910 through 1926, when silent films kind of went out of fashion.
I was going to say, they didn't have a lot 8 to do then.
I know, but 8, that's a eight lot of silent
that's
films.
That's what I mean.
Okay, 12 sound films from 1934 to 2011. We'll talk about those.
Okay.
Radio, 13 radio programs from 1938 to 2016.
I'm impressed.
Television, 18 television series and miniseries from 1949 to 2007. And then theater, like play, performing arts, 18 total from 1849, which literally 2 years after the book was produced, it was on stage.
Yeah.
And through 2016. So just people, there is mass appeal from this story that it is one that you can absolutely successfully adapt to other mediums, which is just fascinating. But I'm like, hey, I mean, I showed up for it. The two or the three that I put on here for us to talk about is the film in 2011 with the Mia Wasikowska. I can never say her last name. She played in Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah,
yes, and Michael Fassbender, which I was like, that's such a fascinating casting. So I'm like, let's talk about that film first, because
and Judi Dench is Mrs. Fairfax.
Okay. Yes, Judi Dench was like my fave.
Yeah,
she was my favorite part. But anyways, Judi Dench is always my favorite part of every film. Like, it could be James Bond, and Judi Dench is the best part of that film.
She's just got something, right?
I fucking love her. She's like this grandma that I really. My life. Like, be my grandma.
Just a sassy little grandma.
Yeah, okay.
Doesn't take shit. So I saw this movie, the 2011 adaption in the theater with some of my other girlfriends. I was so excited because, I grew up on the miniseries.
Right, which we have in here too.
I was like, who was that? Oh, Toby Stevens. I'll pretend like I can remember.
The 2006 BBC series, I don't know why this Sri Lanka one, I had deleted that one like 5 times, but there is literally like, there's a television drama in 2007 in Sri Lanka for Jane Eyre that was like massive.
I love that.
I was like, so Jane Eyre, this is not just in English. They're like internationally made, Jane Eyre has made an impact in film. The BBC series though, it's the gal who has kind of the lips, and she plays in the most recent Golden Compass. as the villain. Oh. You know who I'm talking about?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's a 3-episode miniseries on BBC. I liked it better than any of the films that I've seen.
Me too.
Of Jane Eyre. So I think that's the one we both lined up on.
Yeah, to be clear, the miniseries is best.
Yes. So it's the 2006 BBC miniseries.
Okay.
That's the one that I would recommend. What did you think of the 2011 film, though? I'm interested.
Well, I actually don't think the 2006 is the one I was raised on, right? That there was an older one.
Yes, there it's was.
Like from the 80s or something.
There was a couple in the 80s and a couple in the 90s.
Ah, okay.
That also happened.
I'm trying. Now I can't keep them straight. I'm all, which one did I end up loving? I liked them all for different reasons.
For
the
sure.
original, like, BBC miniseries that I grew up on in, like, the 80s, I feel like, as usual, stays very, very close to the book.
And it's longer because it's like all the words of the book. Jane Eyre's a,
yes.
It's chonky.
It's a chonky book. But it's not as like pow, pow, like exciting.
Right.
And so I think the subsequent movies and adaptions have done a little bit more to, you know,
tighten it,
give it a little something.
Yeah.
And while those moments are great, it kind of feels like they don't know how to fully mesh the two things together. Like adapting the original parts that people love so much with giving it a little more oomph.
Yeah.
I mean, the best version of that that I can recall is probably the new Pride and Prejudice movie, new being relative.
Yeah.
You know, with
Keira Knightley.
Yes, with Keira Knightley. Thank you. I feel like that was a good, perfect mashup where they added some extras in, but they really stayed true to it.
Yeah.
So the movie.
That's because that's the greatest film of all time.
I've ever been made. The movie, though, in theaters was exciting. The bed scene, right? With Rochester. Yeah. And I think all of us were all, okay, we get it. You know, 100%. Michael Fassbender did a great job being aloof, but also, I'm interested.
Aloof and gaslighty.
And gaslighty. But he had less redeeming qualities in that movie. By far.
Yes. That's why I put on here the 2006 BBC, because I felt like the Rochester was more redeemable and more, he was more likable. He was very attractive, I felt like, in that film.
Yeah.
In general, Michael Fassbender is just kind of attractive.
They cast him well, I felt like. I was like, how do I say this? They did a good job casting that one. And I think they did a good job for Mia as well, because Jane, again, is very simple and plain.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the characters from these classics kind of have that going on.
I think it's because a lot of the writers viewed themselves through that lens as well. And so they kind of project into their characters a little bit.
Because I assume that if they're just plain Janes, right, literally where it came from,
mm-hmm.
They're not in high, high society is probably how I looked at it too. Because they don't have as much money to go buy the outfits or makeup or hair.
They just don't have influence and status.
Yeah. Because Jane is like a governess.
Yeah, well, she's an orphan.
And she worked up to be, yeah.
And then she has the opportunity to become a governess, which is a real, you know, kind of like godsend in her situation. Like, she had a horrible childhood. And so in so many ways, Rochester is like totally makes sense as this security for her.
Yeah.
So I understand how a woman in 1847, who has found herself completely abandoned by everyone, an orphan, and her treated very poorly, and her best friend passes away, like in the beginning of the book, and it makes sense why Rochester is a safe place.
Well, she doesn't trust it for a lot of reasons.
And
it literally has never been able to trust anybody in her life. I think is what you're mentioning, but he's showing so much interest in her, like genuine interest. He's being flirty, 100%. That's part of what annoyed me about the book. I'm like, stop it. You're playing with her.
Yeah.
You know, and she was not meaning to, but who wouldn't want to be saved if possible? You know, like she's very independent, but he's got this mansion. He's like wealthy. All these women are trying to date him and he's showing interest in her. And so she's like, is this too good to be true? We're like,
totally.
Kind of, but spoiler.
We're like, it might be.
But in the movie, again, I felt disappointed in the scenes that I hoped they would have put more into.
Yeah.
And then they put a lot into certain scenes that I was like, I guess Hollywood took over. So I gave it like a B-.
Yeah.
Kind of how I felt. What about you on the miniseries that you like your favorite?
Oh, the miniseries? Well, I loved who they cast as Jane, which was that Ruth Wilson.
Mm.
I loved her. I thought she was so perfectly, well, She wasn't quite as plain. It's hard to make her plain. She's a pretty beautiful person. But I just really loved her character. I loved her personality in it. I just felt like she was really vibrant on screen. And then I felt like in this one, Rochester, it's Toby Stevens in this one. He just was more likable, more humorous, more funny. And so that was, it wasn't quite as serious of a take. And I thought they were lovely together. It was just, it was entertaining. I watched all three in a row and it was my favorite adaptation. So it was really beautiful, kind of that 90s cinematography, that like late 90s, early 2000s. Everything kind of has like a orangey glow to it. But
there's been, I'm trying to do a quick count here. There's like 60 plus adaptions.
Oh yeah. I didn't even put in here like graphic novels, retellings, spinoffs.
100 adaptions.
There's at least 100 Jane Eyre adaptions, yes. Like illustrated editions, there's a children's book. I was like, but why? I think it's more like a
real basic premise.
It's like the
is it like Wishbone?
The board books that are like, they take classics and they're not really telling the story. They like make it like a numbers book or the baby blocks or the baby, what is it? Those, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Those board books. So yeah. Anyways, lots of options for you to consume Jane Eyre.
And should we take bets when the next adaption will come out? Who knows?
2000 or 2027.
I thought that in my head.
Boom.
Vibing. Okay. Well, 2027 is going to hold something. We'll see if it's gonna be Jane Eyre.
I'm like, if it's Jane Eyre, you're all freaking welcome.
Maybe they'll get it just right. And do
it's the, you can't get a book that is hopelessly flawed, right?
I can hope. Okay.
It's true. It's true. Okay. TMI, The Mortal Instruments.
I know. I was like, TMI. Oh, yes. Also known as The Mortal
Let's
Instruments.
Let's talk about, we're taking a hard pivot into young adult fantasy.
What,
paranormal fantasy.
This is Mortal Instruments by Cassandra Clare. And they've been adapted into a few different movies/TV shows.
A movie and a TV show. Mm-hmm. The Mortal Instruments follows Clary. Clary Frey.
Yeah, sure.
She has like 100 last names.
And I was like, wait, that's, yeah.
And a group of Nephilim who are known as Shadow Hunters. So Nephilim are in folklore. They are half angelic, half human. And they're called Shadow Hunters in The Mortal Instruments. And if you've heard of Cassie's books, Shadow Hunters has probably come up. This is the first of the Shadow Hunter series that have come out. It came out, but it is the third chronologically. So there's two other series that she has written that chronologically go before this one.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The Mortal Instruments of all of Cassie's series, it is the only one that has been made into movies and film.
Which is a shame. All of her series are so good, so good. But I get why this was like the original. This is like where you get all the backstory about what the Nephilim are.
Yeah, like an intro to Nephilim.
And then as well as what they're here to do, which is to protect basically us non-Nephilim.
Yeah.
All the rest of us humans on this earth who cannot see the demons that are out there.
Literally.
Thanks, Moira.
Literally demons.
And so the Shadow Hunters protect us in a sense. Yeah. You know, they have very special weaponry that is blessed by the angels.
And they have special tattoos that have special spell powers called runes.
Yeah.
And they also wear black leather head to toe.
A lot. Yes.
A lot of leather.
And so the movie came out first.
Yes. And it starred Lily Collins and James Campbell Bower.
I was like, my first like eyebrow raise when they cast that. I was like, something's not lining up for what I imagined.
Yes. I will say, I don't think it was anybody's favorite of the two adaptations between the film and the movie series. Actually, there's probably a few people out there who love the film more. It came out in 2013, and it was met with mixed reviews. Mm-hmm. I think that it was one of the first times that, like, a YA fandom had really pushed or had seen an adaptation.
Yeah.
It was kind of like there was the Twilight and the Hunger Games kind of stuff, but this one was interesting because I feel like Cassie was really well established as an author and this came out and people were, it was a film instead of like a series of films.
Yeah. It was a one and done.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what sticks out to me about this movie? All I remember. because it kind of got deleted from my memory banks, to be honest. But all of a sudden, I'm spacing. Who's like the antagonist? All of a sudden, I forgot his name. Anywho, it just like flew out of my brain. And he is, he keeps trying to recruit a couple of these Nephilim to his side because he's sort of like broken off and sees things very differently. He wants to segregate these pure family lines. It has a very Voldemort vibe going, and that is because the Mortal Instruments series is based off some different fan fiction. Like, if I remember it, like Harry Potter or Twilight, one of the two. And
oh, Valentine. Duh.
Valentine.
Valentine Morgenstern. Yes.
Thank you. So Valentine Morgenstern, yes. Your antagonist. And lots of spoilers around him that I can't get into, but I just remember in the movie, I was like, why is Captain Jack Sparrow on screen? Because they gave him freaking like dreadlocks with beads and stuff. And I'm all, what? What is this? Because I knew Cassie was like, she didn't get a lot of say in it. Most authors don't. But
yeah,
I just, my eye twitched for her.
Yeah, I've always got the impression that was not her favorite adaptation of her work.
Yeah, I think she's just straight up said that.
Yeah.
Well, so the movie was sort of like a C movie for me.
It felt like, honestly, like they probably didn't read the book. Which actually, when talking with Susie Townsend, that was another interesting thing that came up, is sometimes like directors and producers won't read the book. They'll just read the screenplay. And so usually, I think like maybe some of the interesting benefits of that is you're like, okay, does this stand as a good film on its own?
Yeah.
Without having context of the book? But I think it just always pisses off the core fans who read the book, and that's why they're coming to the movie. And it's like, that's a delicate balance. Mm-hmm. Like when you get that right, that's really impressive.
Yeah.
The TV series, however, we loved. Like I freaking loved it. I was like, first of all, it does have all the cheesy Shadowhunter moments. So you're not watching it to be... You are watching it like you would watch like Vampire Diaries, right? Like you're like, it is escapist, paranormal action. And it's for, I would say, like 13 and up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the TV series, I'm trying to remember what it aired on originally.
I got it.
Was it the CW?
Yeah, I think so.
The CW. And what I thought was interesting about it is season one, for the most part, tried really hard to follow the book. They did three seasons based off the series, which is three books for this original drop of books that she created. And then she has expanded her multiverse all over the place, being prequels and other novels afterwards. But those first three novels are the ones that are most established. So they created three seasons based around them. Season one was very much like, okay, we're going to try to stick to the book. And I think it just wasn't working. And so
it's hard because action in a book is fewer and far between.
Yeah.
Action on a show needs to be a lot more.
Like every episode.
Every episode needs to have a mini plot within it. And so the first season is a little bit slower.
Yeah.
I think I just really enjoyed the casting.
It was great casting.
It was amazing casting. My least favorite actually was Catherine, who played Clary. Catherine
McNamara.
Yeah. It's beautiful. It is Latin. Anyways, she was also in like Reacher, Archer, one of those movies. But she was okay. That's what Clary's a hard one to cast because
she's annoying.
She's kind of an annoying character.
I love her, but she's an annoying character.
She kind of is. It's sometimes when you get too much of a 16-year-old's inner dialogue, you're just like, you're annoying. But I'm like, aren't we all? You know? I thought Dominic Sherwood was just hot to look at.
He was a great Jace.
Yeah.
He was great Jace.
He was good. And then, obviously, let's talk about the real stars of this.
Oh, yeah. Let's get Magnus and Alec in here.
Yes. So, I think that's supposed to say Matthew. Sorry. So, Matthew...
Daddario. Oh my gosh.
He's played Alec Lightwood.
Gorgeous.
And Harry Shum Jr. played Magnus Bane.
And Harry Shum Jr. starred originally in Glee.
Yes.
He was one of like the dancer singers. So he's very talented.
Very talented. And Magnus, the story of Magnus is so interesting because Cassie wrote Magnus into the book as kind of this side character in Shadowhunter or in The Mortal Instruments. And then people just became like obsessed.
Well, he is fabulous.
He's this fabulous, he's incredible, gay warlock.
He's like, yeah, he's so old that he's Brooklyn. Just like, I don't know. He's basically bisexual and very open to whatever he's in the mood for.
He's got like cat eyes.
That's his warlock trait.
Yes.
They all have something that gives them away. And I was like, how sexy to have like cat eyes. Well, all the others have like horns and tails and stuff. And so, well, they were really the stars of the show is what we're trying
they
to get
They totally
at.
Took over, which was fucking awesome.
It was amazing because I've never seen two heterosexual males be so into each other for a movie like that.
On screen, just like chemistry.
It was palpably like intoxicating. And I was like, why is this working for me?
It works so well. There's like specifically, so like, I mean, Clary and Jace are the hits of the book. And like, they were great in the series. And Isabel was great. Everyone was really fun to watch. I was thoroughly invested. Simon was great too. The whole three seasons. Loved him. And I'm like, Alec and Magnus were by far like the best part.
Oh my gosh. My favorite episode is still like the one where they fight.
Yep.
And we get to see like a bunch of Harry Shum Jr.'s actual skills as well as like a dancer slash fighter. And then they're just, you know, shirts are off. They're going to town because he's like trying to get back into his fighting like routine, Magnus.
They're dating by this point.
And they're dating this point. And sorry, that's a little bit of a spoiler. But anyways, it's like, for anyone who read Twilight, it's like that moment you've been waiting for in Eclipse where they finally get to the tent.
You're like, yes.
There's not like opposing things happening, but it's just like you've been waiting for it and you're like, it's perfect circumstances. Yes.
Yeah. So there's just this moment where like Alec is like upstairs now. And you're like, this is so awesome.
Yeah. Well, apparently we're doing a great job telling him about our feelings about this.
I'm like, so just excited. Watch it. Just know that like it is like,
it's like a summer read. It's delicious dessert for a TV show that runs in the background.
It's true. And if you're like wanting it to like really challenge your mental faculties, it's like not going to do that. It's just going to be really fun to just watch how the story unfolds.
Yeah.
I also really loved who they cast as Valentine, the more villain, because he was also in Rain as the king in Rain. And I was like, oh, he was by far the hottest part of that film or that series. And that was on CW as well.
Yes.
He was so hot.
He just like rules the CW, apparently.
I know. I was just like, I'm a fan.
I've noticed this because my husband watches the Sci-Fi channel. I'm like, why does that look so familiar? And they use like the same actors and they just rotate through.
They're just like all new the plot. Series. It's the same.
So I'm like, I know the CW has a few of those things. But anyways, we would recommend the TV show.
Yeah.
I would say over the movie.
All right. We're going to pivot into another toxic romance regency. Welcome to Wuthering Heights, where everything is messed up.
End of the synopsis.
100%. This is by Charlotte Bronte's sister, Emily Bronte. Yeah. And to be a fly on the wall in that house.
Wow.
Because talk about the ability to write toxic relationship.
Dude. And they published about the same year, right?
Yes. And actually, I think that Charlotte, I think Emily, so she publishes Ellis Bell, right? She had a pen name as well. This was initially published the same year, 1847. Oh, that's right. And I think that
Courier Bell was Charlotte. And then
yes.
Ellis is for Emily.
Yes. Yeah, so Emily, she died, and which, you know, fucking happens to us all. And
but she was pretty young.
She was young. And Charlotte went and edited the second edition of Wuthering Heights. So she actually has an editing hand in it, which is just very sweet. I like to think that they were both like the Bronte sisters were reincarnated as just like these fabulous heiresses and like lived like this luxurious life as like a reward for writing epic books at a time where women just, it sucked.
Yeah.
Be a woman.
It did. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm just
they deserve the good karma of it.
Yeah.
Or it's like they just came to do what they needed to do, which is leave that literature for the rest of us. Because if I remember right, they kind of periled early. Is that a word?
They met their fate early. They unalived early.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. So Wuthering Heights. This follows the Heathcliff and Catherine's story of total toxic relationship.
Yeah.
Drama.
Again, you know, one of the characters has a pretty tragic, you know, backstory growing up. Clearly, if therapy was a thing, he would have been in it immediately.
No, he wouldn't have. He would have been like, I don't need it.
It's just, he, you know, orphaned in a lot of ways, treated terribly, constantly put down, not worthy, not good enough. Like, that's the rhetoric happening here. And so, you know, he goes on a journey. Basically, he falls in love with, he's like a stable boy or something like that, to that degree, for someone who took him in.
Yes.
And he's doing his part. It's like very Princess Bride. He's in the stables. He's taking mm-hmm. care of things. And she comes out, you know, the owner's daughter of the property, and Catherine.
She's like, farm boy.
Yeah. I never realized it. I'm like, it is kind of like Princess Bride.
Wuthering Heights trope shows up in hundreds of other, I mean, yeah. probably thousands of other novels, romance novels. It's like Wuthering Heights is such a type in romance novels now. So. I get it.
It's just so interesting because, you know, Catherine, who's rich and well taken care of and highborn, is drawn to this, in a sense, lowly stable boy, but they're just attracted to each other. And yes. I think she wants to rebel and do something that's out of character. And I think she's a really wild, free spirit with probably some demons. Like, I think something's going on
mentally.
Yes. Yeah. And thus begins the massively toxic relationship that is Catherine and Heathcliff, which is 100% a reality show.
Yes.
In a book back in the 1800s. And so many people have polarizing feelings about this book. And yes. I fall in the field of, like, I freaking love it because it is so much fun for me to analyze.
Yes.
Not because I relate to any of the characters. Let's be clear. I hope you don't relate to them.
But if you do.
Therapy's a thing now.
There is help.
And also, you know, red flags.
Red flag.
But at the same time, it's interesting just to witness a couple's intense passion for one another. And like that seemed to take over everything else in their lives. Was they're just constantly being drawn to each other. They separate, they come back together. One gets married, the other one gets married, they still come back to each other. So there's like something there that they constantly just had to find each other in this life or the next.
Dun, dun, dun. Spooky sounds.
So that's the fun, twisted story that I'm sure. How many times has this been adapted? It looks like you did some good research here.
Let me tell you.
Tell me.
Sound films, 13 total from 1920 to 2011.
Oh,
television, 18 total from 1848 to 2021. Radio, 8 total from 1941 to 2008. Theater, 10 total. Jeez. There was actually like 4 or 5 operas that were written and depicted.
That makes sense, like, to me.
Yeah, totally, right?
I never even thought about it.
I know. 1951 to 2022. So the theater world has happened with Wuthering Heights and graphic novels one, which I just was like, what? LOL. I'm like, it would be a beautiful graphic novel because it is also set in the moody moors of England. So
okay.
That makes sense.
So I'm guessing the most recent television adaptation is the one I've seen, which is in 2009, PBS put it out with Masterpiece Classics programming, and it was Tom Hardy is Heathcliff, which was perfect casting for the Heathcliff character.
Tom Hardy was amazing as Heathcliff.
Oh, I think he just relates to him a little bit, and I'm all,
yes,
great.
I'm like, I remember seeing pictures of Tom Hardy just like pop up in my feed where he's just like standing butt naked on like a canoe in the middle of a river, like just like stretching. And I'm all, what is happening? And he was like completely unapologetic. He was like, it was my lake. Like, I'm going to, and I was like, that's such a freaking Heathcliff to be like, I am who I am.
I'm all goals in a couple like, ways.
I was just like, that man is freer than I ever will be.
What a gift, right? To just enjoy that.
I was just like, I think that Heathcliff has just this like reckless abandonment of like, I guess, social norms or zero control over his emotions and his actions.
He was a very intense personality in the movie and the books. He's very passionate about what he wants and who he is. He just needed some guidance and filters along the way.
And potentially sertraline.
I mean, I know we're teasing about it, but it's just like things have just changed so much, right?
For sure.
In like 200 years. But it's a really interesting show to watch.
It really is.
We read it for my book club and I warned everyone, you're either going to love it or you're going to hate it. and there was literally no one in the middle. And I told people to maybe watch the show if they were struggling with the book. And so we had a few people that did that. And they were like, nope, hated it just as much as I hated the book. Or,
oh, yeah.
Oh, it was so interesting to watch. You know, it's just you kind so of, analytical. Yeah.
Yeah. You kind of have to like be okay with there not being redeemable characters. Like, I think that's where people, some people are like, it's a waste of my time if there's no one redeemable. And I'm like,
I get it.
I don't think that Wuthering Heights was meant to showcase redeemable characters.
Yeah.
Like, likable is maybe another word. It just wasn't the point.
They weren't even likable.
No. The point wasn't to have likable characters. And I'm like, hey, that's fair.
Yeah. I mean, I don't fully know what the whole point was other than it was an exploration in humanity and all sides.
Yep.
Because I feel like she really focused on just seeing the darker sides of human nature and what that can look like when you put two people together that are struggling with that.
Yeah, for sure. Who are not boundaried. They have no boundaries.
Yeah.
Within themselves or with others. And so it is very interesting. I think both of us as psychology majors really enjoyed psychoanalyzing this one. It also is my favorite special edition we've ever done.
I love it.
It is so beautiful.
I love it. I'm like
plug for that because it is gorgeous.
Yeah, the art is gorgeous. And there's some really macabre moments in the book that we illustrated, I feel like, so poignantly. And it's a little bit haunting. It's a little bit romantic. I love that mashup. So I'm just going to keep pushing it. But
it's true.
Well, for me, I would probably rate this TV adaption, the one that from 2009 with Tom Hardy. I'd give it at least a solid B+.
Yeah.
A minus.
There is like a couple parts where he's like with another woman and you're just like, oh, this is painful. Like it's ick. But I'm like, it's pretty true to the book. And if you're like, I don't want to get through that book. It is interesting. There's also one with Ralph Fiennes, who plays Voldemort. I've seen that one as Heathcliff. And that one was also entertaining. And I do love Juliette Binoche, whatever her name. She's a French actress. She played in Chocolat.
Oh, yes.
She is Catherine in it. And I enjoyed that one too. So
love it.
It's worth a look up.
If nothing else, just to see where you fall of loved it or hated it.
Okay, so we have like at least 15 more on our list. So we might be revisiting this theme of books to movies again, if you folks enjoy them. We're going to wrap up for today in this episode.
Yeah. I feel like we did some good work here.
We did good work. Good work. But we do have a ton more to talk about, like Little Women and Wonder. We have Peter Pan, which the Peter Pan, there's just so many good ones.
It's a journey on that.
Yes. Scarlet Letter. So obviously there's more to talk about. And so we'll be back with more. But for today, reader, thank you for listening to the LitJoy podcast. Please make sure to rate and review us so we can keep doing these very informative episodes.
Yes, and like a good book, recommend us to your friends.